This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Jackie French, welcome back to Better Reading.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah. We've spoken a number of times now, I think, haven't we?
I know. It's more or less come to the stage we don't really want to count the number of years.
That's right. I'm definitely, I'm not counting years anymore, Jackie. I had a milestone birthday the other day, so I'm going to leave it at that.
It's always a shock when you find that you just don't research history. You've actually become an historical artifact in your own right. And that's, a bit daunting.
It is indeed. All right, Jackie French, AM, is an award-winning writer, wombat negotiator, the 2014 Australian Children's Laureate, and the 2015 Senior Australian of the Year. In 2016, Jackie became a member of the Order of Australia for her contribution to children's literature and her advocacy for youth literacy. She is regarded as one of Australia's most popular children's authors and writes across all genres, including adult historicals. Today she's here to talk to me about The Sea Captain's Wife, a compelling story of murder, mystery and mutiny on the high seas. Now, you know, there are a number of authors that write across genres and you know that, but I feel with you, it's absolutely seamless and the love that you have from readers, when I see comments on the Better Reading Facebook page, they like everything you write. They're not looking at specific genre. They'll just read Jackie French.
I think that's something the publishers realised about a decade ago. I started writing for adults, writing short stories. I sent my first book away to Angus and Robertson. They accepted it, but I never thought of it as a children's book. The protagonist was 12 years old, and so they automatically classified it for younger readers. And I think that's why with so many of my books, people who read the Miss Lily series, the Matilda series, they've no idea they were books for children. Most of my letters about Pennies for Hitler and Goodbye, Mr. Hitler come from people, from about 60 to 80, again, who assume these are books written for adults. I think we completely underestimate young people. No one has ever said, you cannot watch that movie because you won't understand it. We say, you can't watch that movie because you will understand it and it is not yet time for you to do so. Mm. And it's the same with writing. Once you have a compelling story, once you've hooked the reader, once they really desperately want to turn the page after page after page, I don't think there is any problem with kids comprehending any book whatsoever. One of my favourite letters came from a 14-year-old boy, intellectually handicapped, from a school for kids with very, very severe intellectual handicaps. And he'd picked up Hitler's Daughter and started to read it. And he read it. It was the first book he'd ever read. They didn't think he could read. He then asked if he could write me a letter, and they didn't realise he could write, but he could. Dear Jackie French, what I have learnt from this book is to be very careful of anyone who tries to make you angry. Love, Joseph. And I didn't realise that was even in the book, and it's a very good thing for a 14-year-old boy to realise. If someone is trying to make you angry, they are trying to get power over you. They are trying to control you. But finally, the publishers let me start writing books for adults again, even books that have got sex in it. They thought before that it would be too difficult for teachers, for librarians, or for people in bookshops to realise that some books of mine were for young people, some books were for older people. I suggested a pseudonym. They said, no, no, it would soon be found out. It would have no point. And gradually they realised that most of the books I wrote, including a lot of the picture books, were being read by every age group. I've realised when I give a talk at a library or a workshop, there will be people there holding their six-month-old babies, assuming they will understand the talk, as well as people in their 90s. But, yes, The Sea Captain's Wife is, I was going to say, a book I've wanted to write since I was 14, but I actually did write it when I was 14. In Mrs. Pawley's English class, and we were studying Golding's Lord of the Flies. And if you haven't read that book, it's about a boys, they've crash-landed on a deserted island. There are no adults, and they have to recreate their own society to survive. And incredibly quickly, it breaks down to factions, it breaks down to hatred, prejudice, and the book ends, in fact, with the hatred being so contagious that even the protagonist is stabbing his best friend, shrieking out, hatred, hatred, kill the pig, kill the pig, kill the pig. The message of that book is that humans are intrinsically violent, and that is what will happen if you leave young people to themselves. And
well, we're seeing that as we speak, aren't we? The world is full of hatred at the moment.
Yes, but hatred is contagious, and so is kindness. And hatred is not a good survival characteristic. So at 14, I wrote a trilogy in rebuttal of the book. In the first book, a group of young people are stranded on an island in the Great Barrier Reef, and they're going to survive. In the second book, they have a chance to return to mainstream society and decide no. They are going to remain isolated. All traces that they are there will be removed. No one will know. They will be a nation of their own, and they will create utopia. Utopia by cooperating, by being nice to each other, by helping each other. In book three, they've achieved utopia. This is a cooperative, friendly, sharing place where most things are held in common. But it's only that way because there are cameras hidden throughout the island, making sure that people do behave well. The heroine finds out, is absolutely horrified. She believes that their lives are completely coerced. And so she decides to kill the person who has put this in place, her boyfriend. She poisons his meal. And as he eats, he confesses to her that, in fact, the cameras are all fakes. No one has ever been observing anyone. It's just that they've learned that cooperating with each other, being nice to each other, sharing things, working at problems together is a survival characteristic. And, of course, he dies in her arms and she sobs melodramatically. And after all, I was only 14 when I wrote the book. A wonderfully melodramatic ending. And I couldn't forget it. My mother actually took the book, the trilogy, to the dump. I'd love to be able to read it again. But the book stayed with me. I really, really wanted to write it. And then in the 1970s, my friend Natalie, much older than I am, we were sitting, I will never forget, in a garden with a basket of scones, an everlasting teapot. And she was wearing this beautiful, thick cotton summer embroidered dress, pleating little flowers embroidered, scattered here, there, etc. And we admired it. And she said she'd inherited it from her great aunt, Bertha. And we ask, well, who is she? And Natalie began the story. Natalie's grandmother lived on an isolated island, which I won't name because, after all, the story did come to me about fourth hand, so I'm not sure of the details. Mm-hmm. All of the men of the island at that time had been killed by a freak wave when they were going to collect eggs on a neighbouring island. It was an island of sailors, an island whose society had grown up when a small boat of shipwrecked sailors and slaves had been cast up there on this completely barren black island. No soil, absolutely nothing except what the sea could give them, the seaweed, etc. And Mr. McCrae, the ship's navigator, who had been brought up on a Scottish island and remembered how they made soil from seaweed. And when the book opens, a paradise has been created, and it's one ruled by the women, much as many islands were, where men left for 3 to 6 years on sea voyages, because that's how long it took if you were a sailor. And usually about one sailor in four would die on every voyage. So even before the accident, husbands were in short supply. So the tradition was, if you wanted a husband, every morning you would go down to the beach to see what the tide had brought in. Useful things like old saucepans, bits of furniture, planks, etc., etc. But also, quite often, men. Beachies, they were called. And when you found a beachie, you had first claim at him. You would take him back to your family's house. He would be cosseted with incredibly good food and a variety of very practiced sexual techniques that the islanders had shared from Francis Lestrange, a ship's whore who had heard of an island of women and had paid a sailor to row her there and had taught these tricks to the women. And so a sailor would be seduced with comfort, with food, with sex, with an island where people shared an enormous number of things, including recipes. But also they would knit for him. Every matrilineal line had its own knitting pattern. And once a man wore your socks with your pattern, no other single woman would ever meet your eyes. No other household would have anything to do with you. You had claimed him before he even realized it. Once he wore your socks, he was yours. Now, some men, of course, would leave, but others, particularly ordinary seamen, would realize that a life being cosseted by these women with a life with far more comfort and luxury than they would ever, ever have. As they grew old and their bodies battered by scurvy, losing their teeth, etc., etc., most of the sailors would stay. And so the island's genetic population would be kept stable. But Natalie's grandfather was a sea captain. He had his mother, his sister, and his aunt to support, and the family owned several ships. He was not a common sailor. And like Mayor's husband, Michael, in The Sea Captain's Wife, he had to leave. And so, like Natalie's grandmother, Mayor returns to Australia to the mansion where the women live, all waiting, watching from the widow's walk for their men to come back from the sea. And they had an extraordinary good life. Every few years, the men would come back, they would be cosseted, and they would go back again. And these women had the money and the freedom to live incredibly good lives. Captains' wives were the backbone of theatrical societies, operatic societies, hiring theatrical companies to come from England to put on plays, etc., etc., learning music, having salons, at night, sitting together, embroidering the absolutely beautiful underwear. And Natalie's dress was, in fact, a petticoat from 1916 that these days could be worn as a dress. And it fascinated me.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I just wanted to ask you, clearly fascinating, and I love the story, but how much research do you do for each book? Do you have a kind of a formula in your head about how much time you spend researching? Because often when I talk to writers that write historical fiction, they tell me that, you know, they have to discipline themselves with the research because you can just go down so many paths and, you know, it's an interest in itself, isn't it? You know, quite separate to writing. So how do you separate those two?
The stories come from something I've been fascinated with for years or for decades and have just followed the path, the research path, trying to actually put all the jigsaw together. And when the jigsaw is there, suddenly I realise that there are themes that go with this story or collection of stories and also that are relevant for today. The only thing I needed to research for The Sea Captain's Wife was how to blow up a steamship and not be caught.
Right.
So anytime you want to blow up a steamship, now I can show you how to do it.
Okay.
It is probably easy to blow up a steamship.
Okay, I'll remember that.
The islanders, however, live on a volcano. Henry Island may be a utopia, but the islanders have learned to ignore the rumbles of the volcano, the warm water that comes out of the caldera and makes the pool that they swim in. It's just Big Henry grumbling. Like most of us, we are very good at not seeing the threats that hang over us. I call it, in fact, second sight. Humans are very good at seeing something unpleasant, like a homeless person, someone in trouble, or for that matter, a climatic disaster about to hit us, and then looking again. Mm. And the second time they look, it's no longer there. Mm. The islanders refuse to see the danger they're in, and it needs an outsider like Michael to warn the Council of Oldies, which is a combination of council and knitting and gossip circle, also while you bring a plate, that they need to find a way of evacuating if Big Henry does start to erupt, and it looks like it might erupt soon. Mm. Mayor goes back to the family mansion on Sydney Harbour and realises that what look like the natural deaths of many members of the family, in fact, are all too convenient. One by one by one, the heirs of the family business, the ships that the family owns, are dying or being killed. As an outsider, she can see there is a psychopath, and the psychopath has to be a member of the family and has to be one who is in a position in all of these different places to kill people in completely different ways. Mm-hmm. It needs an outsider. Mm-hmm. And that really is the theme of the book.
It's incredible. Yeah.
I was just going to say too, but it's also the answer to the question I had at 14. The editors of the book kept wanting me to change bits. If Abici hits a woman, one night he is simply pushed over a cliff and no one talks about him again. If there is a strawberry ram, he becomes roast mutton. You don't breed from a stroppy ram. And they kept on saying, but these are nice women. They wouldn't do this. This is the utopia. And that was not the point. It's not meant as a utopia. It is a lovely place to live. But essentially, it is an island of survivalists. And when they need to be, they can be completely and utterly ruthless and inventive. And that was the book I wanted to write, the theme I wanted to write about. All of us now are really using second sight. We are threatened by the most horrendous of volcanoes, by so many threats from climate change. We've got two choices.
Yes, with
climate change, the bushfires, the floods, the emerging deserts, the emerging areas that are becoming marshes rather than food-producing areas. We've got two choices. We can fight for the remaining resources or we can cooperate. And once you cooperate, you form bonds that more than double your resources because you've got many cultures, many minds, many ways of looking at things, working out how to solve these problems. War is the most extraordinary waste of resources, of land, of destruction to the world where it is being fought. And we are wasting so much of the very little time we have got as a species fighting for these resources, instead of working out ways they could be shared, where you look at what is happening in Ukraine and in Russia, in Israel and in Gaza. Essentially, it's about resources. And if they could just have actually sat down with a very good place, plate of scones or maybe karotsi or a bit of vodka instead of a teapot, and actually talked about, we have got this problem. We have got two nations that need to survive. Things are getting difficult. How can we do this together? And I think it's something we need to teach young people, working cooperatively instead of fighting. How do we solve this problem? Is something that will stay with them when they are adults. Do not shut your eyes to danger, but instead find other people and work to solve the problem.
Well, I think everybody should be reading Jackie French. Tell me, I can see that wombat behind you, and I know we've had this conversation before, but where the interest in wombat started? How is it you and wombats became connected?
I wasn't interested in wombats at all. I'd never met a wombat. I wasn't interested in wombats. I really like kangaroos and dogs better than wombats. But for several years, well, I lived in a tent and I lived in a shed. The concrete that had been poured for the house was rotten. It took 3 years for the court case for us to get our money back so we could build again. And I lived in the shed by myself except at weekends. And every morning I would go out and sit on the ridge by the shed and have my breakfast looking down the valley. And there would be a wombat eating the last of his food before he went back to his burrow for the day. And he was obviously interested. He hadn't ever seen an animal like me before. I was obviously a threat. Every day I did the same thing, walked up, ate muesli from a bowl, drank my cup of coffee, went back again. He kept coming closer and closer. He started sitting on the doorstep every time I played the violin. He'd never heard music before. He was obviously fascinated by the melody that was like a wild bird's melody, but was different. He would love it when I played different tunes. He didn't like rock music, though, if I put that on the radio.
A wombat with good tone.
Or melodic. No, not words, just melody. And he made it very clear that he thought I needed to learn things, just like mother wombats in the pouch. They show them where the springs are, high up in the cliffs that don't dry up even in the worst drought, where the best grass is, where the paths are. He showed me wombat sits. Now, one of them was in this great big lightning blasted half tree. And there was a wombat hole right down under the roots. And the wombat, possibly generations ago, had hollowed out the rotten wood of the tree and tamped down on the top this great big flat area where you could sit and look down the entire valley.
Wow.
And okay, what was happening? Why? Wombats are short-sighted. They can only see dirt and grass and what's exactly in front of them. I mean, why would a wombat want to look at a view? They were vulnerable there to wedge-tailed eagles. Why did they do it and spend so much time? And I suddenly realized they saw it by the way they smell. Dogs can smell 10,000 times better than humans. They can pick up diseases, stress, all sorts of things, simply from sniffing. Wombats can smell 10,000 times greater than dogs.
Oh, wow.
When a wombat looks at a view, it's not just seeing what's there. It's seeing what has been there. For years or possibly decades. It's got a way of viewing things which is so alien to humanity. A wombat basically lives history. And when you know history, you can predict what is going to happen. Anyone who says you cannot use the past to predict what is going to happen tomorrow or next year either is a very bad historian or is just rather scared of know the past. You can predict with extraordinary accuracy what is going to happen and pretty much when, but people don't want to know. When I wrote the nonfiction book, Let the Land Speak, I think there were 20 predictions, but we had to revise them right up until their book went to print because they kept on coming true. So I had sort of put in an prediction, because yes, I was right, this was going to happen. There was Christchurch was going to be destroyed by an earthquake. The earthquake happens 2 days before the book goes to print, so we have to put in another catastrophe. I tried to talk to that to a panel at a writers' festival. They wanted to say, okay, you've been predicting the future in this book. What do you think is going to happen in the next 10 years? And I started off. I started off, in fact, with the fires that we had in the summer of 2019-2020. Then I went on to the pandemic, which I said, look, we've got probably about 5 years before there's going to be the worldwide pandemic. And just someone else on the panic has gone saying, no, it's going to be wonderful. It's going to be like World War, just after World War One. We're going to have the roaring 20s. Everyone's going to really enjoy themselves. We've gone through this, etc. And I realized, look, it's the problem Cassandra had. You know the future, but people do not want to see it. They don't want to hear about it. They only want to hear about the good things. It is perfectly obvious in The Sea Captain's Wife that these people are being murdered. It is all too convenient, getting rid of air after air after air. But no one wants to think about it. I remember when things were being stolen from us. And we mentioned that to our solicitor. And he asked, well, who had access to it? And we said, oh, well, this person, but oh, well, it couldn't be her. It really couldn't be her. He just sat back and he laughed and he said, the number of times I have heard people say that. He said, every time someone says, oh, it couldn't be Uncle Harry, you know, right, it's Uncle Harry. It's when you think, no, this can't happen with so much determination. It means that you've closed your eyes and you refuse.
Constantly, Jackie, shocked by some of the decisions that we're making in this world at the moment. And you think, what are we doing? Anyway, listen, I want to end on this bright note. We're out of time. We'll speak to you again next year, I'm sure. But thank you so much for the conversation today. The book is called The Sea Captain's Wife, Jackie French. Thanks again.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, I have made the book sound very worthy and rather like a sermon number 56. I promise it's not.
It's not.
Adventure, it is a mystery. And hopefully once you have read the first page,
you'll be hooked.
Look, I know a book is working when I'm reading a book at night and I think, oh, no, look, I don't want to read this. I want to go back to reading this one. And I realise I can't read it. That's the book I'm writing. I'll have to wait till I finish it.
There you go.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, lovely. Bye-bye.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBookstore. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.